ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभ्यश्वनयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षिभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टवागुंसस्तु नूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तारक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः.
We're on the Alata Shanti, the chapter 4. And we're on, really on verse 6. I'm going to review back to verse 4. We haven't had class in Manduki for a long time. Actually, we'll go to, well, we're going to chant from verse 3. Okay. Just repeat after me.
Bhutasya jatam icchanti. Bhutasya jatam icchanti. Varina kecharevahi. Varina kecharevahi. Abhutasya pare dhiraha. Abhutasya pare dhiraha. Vivadanta parasparam, vivadanta parasparam. Bhutam najayate kinchit, bhutam najayate kinchit. Abhutam naiva jayate, abhutam naiva jayate. Vivanto dvaya hyevam, vivanto dvaya hyevam. Shanto dvaya hyevam ajatim khyapayantite, ajatim khyapayantite. Khyapyamanam ajatim taihi, khyapyamanam ajatim taihi. Anumodamahevayam, anumodamahevayam. Vivadamo nataiv sardham. Vivadamo nataiv sardam avivadam nibodhata, avivadam nibodhata. Ajatasya eva dharmasya, ajatasya eva dharmasya. Jatim icchanti vadinaha, jatim icchanti vadinaha. Ajato hyamrito dharmo, ajato dharmo marutyatam katameshati, marutyatam katameshati.
So more or less, going back to verse 3, I'm just going to kind of tell you, remind you of this progression from verse 3. In verse 3, it would say, there are some vadinaha, vadins. A vadin is somebody who has taken a philosophical position. Like they would belong to some darshana, they have a philosophical position. And in this case, we're really dealing with the dvaitins, those who accept duality in one form or another. In fact, unless you, because we all experience duality, right? Duality means the experience of more than one. Subject-object enough. Subject-object is two. There's a subject and object. That's enough for duality, let alone this whole manifest creation. So to not accept duality, to say that everything is non-dual, that the reality is non-dual, that means one without a second. The only way that that is possible, because here we are experiencing duality, is for what we call duality to be mitya. Mitya means that it has this duality, subject-object, and everything that we perceive as a second, right, has no intrinsic being of its own, but is totally dependent upon the nature of what we call satyam, what is real, the one non-dual reality. For instance, if we look at the wave ocean, if we look at the ocean with countless waves, the whole ocean is made of just a display of different sizes of waves and foam, etc. So there's duality. But if we look at it from the standpoint of water, it's non-dual. Water is satyam. Means water is what is actually there. It doesn't matter how big or small the wave is. It doesn't matter how many waves there are. It doesn't matter that all the waves are contained in one large ocean. Right? Nevertheless, there's only one water there. This is the satyam-mitya relationship. The whole Vedanta is this, that all the duality, the subject, object, seer, seen, and the duality in terms of what our sense organs, the display of our sense organs, or all of the different thoughts and feelings and emotions in the mind, all have only one essential reality, one essential being, which is just Satchit, which is the conscious being which I am. So that's the Satyam Mitya. Otherwise, how can you even talk about non-duality? Because Advaita, it means one without a second. That means there's nothing here, really. Like if we take the clay pot and I say to you, there is a clay, there's some clay, and there's a pot. You say, that's not. It's not clay and a pot, as though there's two things there. There's clay. There's really only clay. And then there's a pot, right? That, and then there's a pot, which is really only clay. That's what we mean by mitya. So to understand Advaita is to understand the satyam-mitya relationship so that I can say this whole infinite display of this creation, the subject-object relationships, this whole infinite display has only one non-dual being, which is me. And another beautiful thing about really understanding the Advaita is that that one being has got to be you. Because there's only one. Right? There's only one. So who are you then? You're either not here, you know, you're not here, or you're that. So that's the means that, you know, that aham brahmasmi, advayatma, I am the self, which is in reality the self of all beings, the self of the whole creation, the self of Ishvara. That is Advaita. Anything other than that is Dvaita. Because we have the experience of duality. And so now, this section right here is looking at Advaita versus Dvaita in reference to this creation. So the question is this. This creation, you say this creation, is this creation born? Is the self born or modified into this creation? Or not? Or does this creation, does it come from the self? Is the self born to become this creation? You know? Or does this creation come from nothing? Is it a set? So these kind of questions have to be discussed. So this is kind of the genre of what we're talking about here in this section. So here he says in verse 3, and so this is a progression now, so I'm just going to kind of quickly go through these verses to get to 6 where we are. He says, kechit vadinaha, some disputants, some people are holding this philosophical position. So some vadins, some of them propose, ichanti, that jatasya, bhutasya, jatam, something which has been, bhuta means something which exists, right? Their birth comes from, there is birth for something which exists. Something which exists is born. Bhutasya jatim. Jatim means is born. So that some people are saying, okay, something that is born, something that exists, that is born. Okay. But other diraha, other thinkers, he's being sarcastic when he says that, other bright ones, he goes, this is sarcasm. In the literature, you know, the they'll often be joking. So it goes like this. Other bright ones, other of these Dirahas, they say that birth, Jatim, is for something which doesn't exist, abhutasya. So when something is born, is it being born from something that is? Or is it being born from something which is not, which is non-existent? So abhutasya, right? Abhutasya jatim, or bhutasya jatim. So these people, these two positions are arguing with each other. It says, vividantaha parasparam, with each other, they're in debate, right? The Sankhyas will really say that what is born, what is manifest here, is manifest from the prakriti, right? So prakriti is, and prakriti, you know, displays as this creation. The other one will say, that can't happen. It can't be, something can't be born from something which is already there, right? Because it's already there. How can you say it's born? How can something be born from something that's already there? So that's not going to be the case. If something is born, it has to be have a prior condition of not being there. Okay? Like the Vaisheshikas and others have somewhat of that position. Okay, so here's the argument. So then in verse 4, he says again, here's the argument. Bhutam najayate kinchit. Some will say, bhutam najayate, what exists, this is the argument against the Sankhya, something that is bhutam, something that exists, has come into being, that's not born, because it's already there. So some people say, what exists, that's not born, because it's there. But abhutam naiva jayate, but then again, the other side of it, and they will say, the other people will say, arguing with each other, yeah, but abhutam naiva jayate, what does not exist can't be born, because it's not there. So, say the Sankhyas are saying, the Sankhyas want to prove that birth takes place for something which is there, which already exists. And the disputant will say, that's not possible. Something that is already there can't be born because it's already there. But then the Sankhya will come back and attack the other person's position who is saying, birth can only take place for something that's not there, that doesn't exist. And the Sankhya will come back to the Vaisheshika and say, that's impossible because if there's something not there, nothing can be born from it. Because it doesn't exist, right? So here Gaudapada says, these people disputing in this manner, they are really, there's two ways to take this, I'll take them both as, they are really just non-dualists. They're non-dual. Because they're negating each other. We said, we agree with what they say. They're negating each other. In the end, they become non-dual because they are propounding, they are putting forward a jatim, that there can be no birth. Either way, birth can't come from something which exists, nor can it come from something which does not exist. So what does that mean? It means, well, there can't be any birth then. And he says, as an Advaita, I say, yeah, that's exactly what we're saying. You're an Advaitin. So you can take this by Sandhi, it can say vivadantaha advayaha, or you can have an avagraha there, and it would say vivantaha. If you have an avagraha, it would go for Sanskrit people. Vivadantaha dvaya. I know, but there's a second way of reading. Swamiji takes it the second way, uh-huh. Or it can be vivantaha dvayaha. So you can say, these Dvaitins who are arguing among themselves, really, in like this, really they're just proponents of ajati, which is who we are. Ajati means no birth. Or you can take it, these disputants arguing like this among themselves are really
just Advaitins like us, because they also are saying there's no such thing as birth. And so you can take it like either way. They have they have it both ways. So then he goes in now to verse 5. Kyapyamanam ajatin taihi. Anumodamahe vayam. He says, anumoda means with rejoicing, happily. We happily accept. Vayam means we. Anumodamahe. We happily accept this ajati, which is being proposed by them. Right? We happily accept what they're saying. Vivadamaha natayhi saradam. We don't dispute or argue with them in any way. Saradam taihi means with them, like if two people are arguing, saradam means we're having this argument, this discussion together. But we're not disputing with you. In our conversation with you, we're not having, there's no dispute. We're agreeing with you. Then Gaudapada says, avivadam nibodhata. He's talking to his students now, and he says, understand, let me explain to you. Nibodha means like, let me tell you, let me explain to you this avivadam, this position which has no dispute. There's no way to dispute it. So we're not, there's no argument. We're not arguing with anybody. So that takes us up to 6, okay. We did 6 last time, we touched on it, but now we're going to really start from 6. So he says, ajatasya eva dharmasya jatim ichanti vadinaha. Ajataha hi amritaha dharmaha marchitam katam eshati. He says, dharma means a thing. Dharma has many meanings. One is a thing, a vastu. So here, dharma means just a vastu, a thing. So he says, ajatasya eva dharmasya. For a thing, for something, any type of thing, dharma, anything that is, which is ajatasya, jatam ichanti vadinaha. These bodies, they want to propose, ichanti, means they're proposing, they're suggesting, that there is birth for a thing which has never been born. Ajatasya, right? Something that is, which itself has indeed never been born. So now we're talking about the Atma. For something which has never been born, these bodies, they want to propose, they want to suggest that there is birth. That there is a birth for something which by its nature has never been born. Ajatasya eva dharmasya. Jatam ichanti vadinaha. So these people, they want to say that for something that is, exists, but that thing that exists, this is important because there's nothing in the world like this. This thing exists, but this which exists, it has never been born. It is, but it has never been born. They want to say that that there is birth for such a thing, that such a thing will be born. So now he says, ajataha hi amritaha dharmaha, for that thing which is unborn and amrita, free from birth and free from death, marchitam katam eshati. Eshati is in the future tense from E. It says, how can something which is ajata, it has never been born, and is amrita, it is not subject to death, how can that thing become mortal? Marchitam, be mortal. How can it gain the state of being mortal? How can it morph into that? How can it become something that is mortal? Okay, so there's something you have to understand here. For these three verses, Gaudapada is taking these three verses from chapter 3. We've already done these verses. But he's bringing, there's been a whole logic to establish these verses. And now he's repeating these three verses, this 6, 7, and 8 here.
because it speaks to the question.
Verses from the Upanishad?
No, verses from the Gaudapada. It's verses 21, 22, and 23 from the previous section. So what he's saying, what's important here, he's already established ajatasya eva dharmasya, that the Atma, the self, is something that is free from birth. Mm-hmm. So for the self, which is free from birth, so if I take this, the dharma nano vastira, it's referring to the Atma. So for the Atma, the self, which is free from birth, these people want to say that it has been born. Right? How can something which is ajataha and amritaha, how can that, as though we'll see from the next verse, how can that morph into or become something, change into, gain the state of mortality? Right? If it is, in fact, something that has never been born. It is. See, this is the thing. You say ajatasya, dharmasya. We're talking about a thing which itself has never been born. If something is, and it has never been born, that something is free of time. It's free of cause and effect. Try to understand. We only, in terms of our human experience, our experience in the world, everything is interdependent and interrelated. There is a continual, endless change, relationship of cause-effect relationship. Any change is a birth, right? It's a death. Any change is the death of the prior condition and a birth of the new condition. Any change, any moment of change. Even if I use the clay pot, if I have a pot, and now forget about the clay for now, even though it's always there. Because what is always there, right? So even but if I just take the clay, say I take a clay pot and I make it into a plate, so easy to do, you know, wet clay, I have a pot and I make it into a plate. Okay. Now, the pot has died. Right? It's gone. That pot doesn't exist anymore. Right? Now the plate exists. So just think this, any moment to moment within duality, every moment is the death of the prior moment. Right? Every moment. And so, how in this creation, right, how in this creation can there be something which is ajata, unborn? Because you have to stop time for that. It would be like we have to get a still frame, you know, as though there's a still frame and now all time has stopped. So now there's no birth or death. So that's not possible within creation. So now you say, here is something for something that has not been born. Okay. Now can you say for that which has not been born, can that thing die? It's never been born. That means it's free of time. And so now how can it die? Right? So it's that which is free from birth is by its very nature free from death, right? Because it's never come into being. It is, but it's never come into being. And so it can never go out of being because it has nothing to do with time. It has to be beyond time. It has to be free from time. What in the creation is free of time? Right? Time and space are kind of the fabric of the creation and of all things that exist within time. All things that exist within time and space are subject to time and space. You know, think of it like the time and space being the fabric in which all things are. That's just one way of saying it. So that means all things that are subject to time and space, which means all things are subject to birth and death. You have to stop time, otherwise you can't do that. So now he says, these vadins desire, what they want to propose is that there is a birth for something which has never been born. That thing which has never been born will have a birth. And then he says, for something which has never been born, and therefore has never died. It's going to be, because it's going exactly the same on either end. It's never been born, and therefore it's amrita, also it's free from death. So something that's free from birth and free from death. How is it possible for that thing, whatever it is, we're talking about the Atman context, for that thing to become marjitam, to kind of become now mortal, become something which is subject to birth and death? What is going to be the instrument that would bring that about? It's good for contemplation. So he says, Katan Eshati. Eshati means, how is that possible for that thing to then take up, change into something that Eshati become? How can it go into that state of mortality? How would that be possible? And so that's the question. Now he's going to sit with that for a while. So let's do this next verse. Nabhavatimritam maracham na. Nabhavatimritam maracham na. Maracham amritam tata. Maracham amritam tata. Prakrite anyata bhavaha. Prakrite ranita bhavaha nakatan chipavishyati nakatan chipavishyati na bhavati amritam marcham na marcham amritam tata prakritehe anyata bhavaha nakatan chipavishyati. He gives a logic here to now trying to make you understand why this is not possible for this to happen. So it goes, what na bhavati amritam marcham? Something which is amritam, free of death, that cannot become marcham. That cannot become mortal. Something which is amritam, free from death, by its nature, we'll see in the next line, but just let's take this line first. This is just a statement. It's what's called a pratignya. This is the logical statement that he's going to make and then develop. What is amritam, free of death? Mrita means that which has died, that which is subject to death. Amrita, that which is free of death, the unnegates. So, amrita nabhavati marcham. That which is amrita, free of death, that cannot become mortal. Then he says, na marcham amritam tata. Similarly, tata, that which is marcham, subject to death, mortal, that cannot become amrita, free of death. So he says, why can't it? So he says, why can't it? Prakritehe anyata bhavaha na kachanchit bhavishyati. He says, na kachanchit, never, at any time, in any way. When you take this indefinite and put a na, it makes it an absolute. Take an indefinite article, make it a negate, it becomes an absolute. So katanchit means somehow, some way. Na katanchit, in no way, it's not possible. Mm-hmm. Never at any time is this point, and in no way is it possible. What? That bhavishyati, never is it possible that anyata bhavaha prakritihi. Prakriti means for the nature of a thing. The prakriti here, he's going to define later what exactly prakriti means. But your prakriti means the nature of a thing. Anyata bhava. Bhava means becoming anyata, other than what it is. It is never seen. This is future. It will never be seen. It never happens. Except that the nature of a thing becomes something else. So a thing actually changes its nature. Never, in no way can that happen. That bhavishyati is the future in the future. So the becoming of something other than its own nature, this is not something that we ever see. And they give the example, just like for fire, its swabhava is hot. Fire is meant to be hot. Water is meant to flow. Water will flow downhill. It has all of these different examples about the nature of a given thing. Mm. So things don't they don't change their nature. So if something by nature is immortal or free from death, that is its swabhava. Swabhava means that's what's intrinsic to it. It can't become something which is mortal. And so now we can look at ourselves. We are mortal. Okay, this body is mortal. But we're going to become immortal. Are we going to become immortal? Can this body become immortal? Which is very swabhava, it's very nature for every part of this body to be continually, you know, changing and then going through the shad bhavas, the six stages from birth to death. So this body is not going to become mortal. It can become very old. You know? So don't sometimes laugh and joke, you know, when a person becomes old, they start to crunch down, you know, the poor little skeletal frame is started straight up, and then it starts to crunch down a little bit, and then crunch down a little bit more, and then turn around, kind of like a snail. But eventually the poor thing is going to fall apart, and you might be able to extend it as much as possible, but only as much as possible. That is not its swabhava. If its swabhava were to be free from death, it is free from death. It's free from time. There is no change. It's not subject to death. And so, but if something is subject to death, how are you going to change it into something that is free of death? You're asking it to change its prakriti. You're asking it to change its nature. And that's not something that it can do. And so now, he wants to talk about how he's using this word prakriti. Okay? So he goes, so as you can see, these are kind of building one on another. He goes, no, that's two verses. This first verse. Svabhave namrto yasya. Svabhave namrto yasya. Dharmo gacchati marjitam. Dharmo gacchati marjitam. Kritike namrta. Kritike namrtas tasya. Kritike namrtas tasya. Katam stasyati nischalaha. Katam stasyati nischalaha. Svabhavena amritaha yasya dharmaha kachati marjitam. Kritikena amritaha tasya katam stasyati nischalaha. He gives a logic for why this is not going to happen, where something whose dharma is amrita, free from death, how it cannot go to something whose dharma is to be mortal. So he says, svabhavena amritaha yasya dharmaha kachati marjitam. He says, yasya means for someone who, for whom, means for whom, whoever holds this position. What position? If a disputant who holds this position and says something, a dharma, some dharma which is amrita, immortal, swabhava, by its very swabhava, by its nature. So for a person who holds this position, that something which exists, a dharma, is amrita, is immortal, by its swabhava, by its very nature. He says, if he holds a position that such a thing, gacchati marjitam, goes to death. Right? It goes into that, it dies. Something which is immortal by nature, nature goes to death, that person, how katam stasyati nischalaha, for him, for that person, how can that which he's claiming to be amrita, how can it remain nischala? How can it stay that way? Stasyati, how can it hold that position? How can it keep its swarupa, its dharma of being nischala? Nischala means free of any type of movement, any type of change, right? How can it remain amrita? Means free of, it has to be free of change to be amrita, not be subject to any change or death. Nischala, how can it keep it that, how can it keep that position? How can it stay that way when Kritikena means when it's something that is a product. It's a product because it's been born, right?
It's changing. It's becoming immortal. That means it's got parts. It's changing. Something is being produced there. If something is being produced, if it's kritika, if there's some cause-effect relationship happening there, if something's being made, right, you're changing it, right? That's kritika. You're changing it. You're taking something amrita, and you're changing it now. How can that happen? How can something which was free of change, because amrita, it's free of death, how can you say how can you keep it in your mind that that thing is still amrita when now it's changing to become martya, to become mortal? Can something which is by its swabhava free of death stay free of death and become mortal? You see what I mean? It's not possible at all. That's what this one vadin is saying. Something that is, you know, amrita, like the Atman we're saying is amrita. It's free from death by its nature. That is its swabhava. Now you're saying that that is going to be born. Right? That's the death of that thing, because now that's going to change. That now is going to be born. But then what's happened to the one that's being born? That one's not there anymore. It's lost its nature. So Gaudapada is saying, I don't see how this is possible. How can it stay as it was? See, that's that stasyasi. How will it remain? Sta means to stay, to remain. How will, and this is future, how does it remain? That dharma which is free from death, how does it remain? How does it stay itself? How does it remain nischala? Meaning going through no modification. How does it stay free from death if it's going to become mortal? That doesn't make any sense. It's leaving its nature, you know. It's an interesting idea. Like, it's, you can do it, and we'll do it in the opposite way later. Like, if you say, I am going to become immortal. I am going to become free of death. Well, what part of you is going to become free of death? Is that which has, by its very swabhava, by its very nature, it is subject to time, it is subject to change, it is subject to decay, it is subject to death. How are we going to make this free of death? How is that going to take place? Because you're asking to change the very nature of something. And it works in the opposite way too. If something by its very nature is free from death, therefore it's free from birth, it's free from time, it's not subject to that, then you're asking it to become mortal. How is it going to make that transition from that which is free from death to that which is subject to death? Another way of understanding this is, how is something which by its nature something funny happening.
I'm going to take off your headset.
No, just a minute. Maybe it's okay now. Okay. You're asking something. You're asking me, say my being, the Atma, which is amrita, ajata, which is free of birth and free of death, that's its nature, it's free of time. How can it join the world of time? Let me give you an example. We have Bhagavan, of course, so in his own great kindness, infinite compassion, has given us the dream and imagination, which is incredible, actually. That we have such a thing as a dream, or even such a thing as imagination, really is the Achilles heel to understanding the mityatva of this creation. When you're having a lucid dream. Within the lucid dream, I'm just making it lucid dream because you're awake. Your consciousness is awake, but there's nothing covering your being, so to speak, and yet this dream is taking place. So what is the relationship between the self, the conscious being,
and the dream. The dream by its very nature and everything in it, the dream is within the fabric of time and space. Just like this universe, it's contained within the fabric of time and space. So everything in that dream is infinitely divisible. Everything within the dream on every level is continually going through change, through birth and death. And everything in the dream, everything in the dream is coming into being, going out of being, coming into being, going out of being. So we say within the dream, there's birth and death. Right? Now, how are you, the conscious being, from whom this dream has come, the conscious being who, from the standpoint, I won't even talk about Atman, from the standpoint of this dream, how can you, your being, join or change your nature to become an object in that dream? How can you, consciousness, be born into the dream? How can you, as consciousness, I'll say it in different ways, how can you, the conscious being, become the dream? Does conscious being become the dream? Does it morph its nature into the dream? Right? Nothing happens, in fact. To conscious being, the dream comes, right? The dream comes from conscious being, is sustained by conscious being, resolves into conscious being, but conscious being is not changing to become the dream, right? The conscious being doesn't become the dream. It doesn't sustain itself as the dream. It doesn't resolve back into itself. So this is the Advaita. This is that Satya-Mitya relationship. We would never say that consciousness becomes the dream, that it changes, that it is born into the dream, that it goes through a modification to become the dream. Consciousness is non-dual. It's ajata. For consciousness, there's no beginning. It's not like consciousness, conscious being, such it came into being, that consciousness was born. Consciousness was born, what was its prior condition? And consciousness being free from time, being free from birth, which is being, I say it's free from birth, it's free from change. Now, all of a sudden, how is it going to die? It's free of change. If it's never been born, how is it going to die?
So where is the illusion born of? Where is Maya springing from
there? I'll talk about it and hold your question and we'll have some satsang at the end and talk about it. That's a good question. That's where we're going. So here, will we say, even as Advaita, and can the Dvaitin even say, that the dream or the creation, right, is born from consciousness?
No.
Yeah, can I say? It can't say. It can't say that the creation is born from consciousness, because then the idea would be that consciousness itself is morphing, changing into the creation, right? So there really is no birth of the creation. How is there a birth of the creation? And is there any even death of the creation? Can you look at it from both sides? Is there a birth of the creation? Is there a death of the creation? What is the substance of the creation in the first place? So would we say that there is a birth of the self to become the creation? Right? And then how would there be a death? What would that be? So we say that for the Atma, for the self, there can be no, because ajata, free of time and space, there is no birth or death. It can't morph. It doesn't have the tools within itself in order to morph into the creation, because it has no parts and it is free of time. Whereas the creation itself, how can the creation, even from this standpoint also, how can the creation itself come into being? From where is it coming into being?
From where?
From where? From where? Yeah, from where? That's exactly what we say. It isn't coming into being. What is mitya is not coming into being. Let's look at it like this. if we look at it like the clay pot example. If I have a lump of clay and I make that lump of clay into a pot, okay,
Now, this is interesting. Has the pot been born? This is what all this is getting to.
Yes.
Has the pot been born? Well, what has it been born of? See? And if I make it into a plate, has the pot been killed? What kind of a birth and death is that? Because actually the only thing there is clay, which has not changed its nature. And so this idea of birth and death and change is all in the realm of mithya. Mithya has no essential nature of its own. The only nature that is really there is clay. Right? And for clay, even though it's a pot or a plate or a tumbler or back into a ball, nothing has happened to the clay. The clay has not changed its nature. Clay is clay. It hasn't been born and it hasn't died. But all the while, there's been a plate. There's been a plate and a tumbler and a plate and all of these, you know, pot and all of these type of nama-rupas, names and forms. Now when you start analyzing all of the names and forms, like even if I look out here into this world full of names and forms, right, you can't find in any given name and form, you can't find a substance here. That's what we mean by mithya. There's two reasons. You can go at it from two things. This is the maya of this creation. This is the dreamlike nature of this creation. If we try to find a real thing here to say that it has been born, you know, and that it dies, first thing we have to do is find the thing. We have to find what we call the Dharma, the thing that actually exists. And this we cannot do. We cannot find the thing. As long as our something is existing within time and space, and we have that subject-object relationship, the reason we can't find the thing is twofold. One is that anything that you call a thing is actually a conglomerate of things within things within things within things into an infinite regress. As long as the thing takes up space, it can be divided into two things. That's an infinite regress. In order to find the thing, we have to find the substance itself. And where's the substance? We keep dividing and all we get are more things. That's why Swamiji will say, I love how he says this. It's the most beautiful way to say it. Instead of even dealing with things, he says, there are no things. There are no things here. There are just names within names within names and with names of Brahman. That's what it is. Because I say this lamp, this is a name for this. It's only a nama. It's only a name for this conglomerate of things put together. We call it a lamp. But now we take the lamp apart and now we have a bunch of other names for what is actually here. Right? And then we take those parts apart and then we have other names. So we're just naming these parts, names and names and names of what is actually here. But what we're in Maya, within Maya, it's just names within names within names within names within names into an infinite regress until you recognize, well, what actually is the substance for this infinite regress? What is actually the being here? Because you can't say, you also can't say, that all of this is non-existent. You can't say it's non-existent because here we are. There is nothing but existence here. The namas, the names, you know, the names disappear, are replaced by other names. Replaced by other names and other names and other names and other names. But what is never replaced or changed or threatened in any way is the being which these names enjoy. But all the way, well, okay, the lamp is, the parts of the lamp are, the molecules are, etc. They all is. That isness is inviolate. The isness is free from birth and death. All this birth and death, all this change, this infinite regress of names within names within names within names, these things are born. The names, infinite regress to not be able to find a thing, but
The thing is always here. You can't find a thing, but you are the thing. You can't find a thing by looking within duality for the thing. You can only be the thing. You are the very being of what is actually here. Now, if you go into your own body, this also is names within names within names within names. Go into your body, your mind, your sense organs, dividing them up, you can't find anything here either. You can only be it. You only are it. But that you are itself is not an object that you can look at. It's the very substance, which is the self of all things. That's conscious being. Conscious being never comes into being or goes out of being. All namas are names within names and with names of being itself. I would say of conscious being. The other way to this, to understand it, there is nothing here within duality that isn't subject to change. And now, any moment of change is the death of the prior moment, right? So everything that we experience here is bordered by, on both ends, it's bordered by non-existence because it comes into being and goes out of being. Like, look at the clay pot. If I make a pot out of the clay, the pot was not here before. The pot has come into being. So the prior condition of the pot is non-existence. There was no pot, now there's a pot. Now I make the pot into a plate, now the pot is gone. So the pot has non-existence on either side. You see that?
Yes.
Non-existence. That means if it's non-existent on either side, it can't be existent in the middle. Nothing can come from nothing, right? So this is what we mean by mithya. It has no being of its own. Its prior condition and posterior condition is non-existent. There was no pot, now there's a pot, now there's no pot. Nothing can come from nothing, right? And yet, there's the pot, right? There's the pot because clay is, right? So mithya, this is what mithya is. It has no independent being. The only reason the pot can be there is because there's clay. If I take the clay away, there's no pot. And the pot isn't coming into being or going out of being. The clay is not coming into being or going out of being. The pot is. And so now, you have to look at this whole thing as a clay pot. Yeah. An infinite clay, with nothing but clay, ever, anywhere, nothing but clay. And all of this maya, because coming into being and going out of being, right? Nothing is happening. Nothing is happening. Look at the clay pot. Nothing is happening. Clay is clay. That's why when you wake up, little aside, that's why when you wake up from a dream, this universe, this dream universe with all the complexity and all the relationships and everything going on in this dream universe, the alarm goes off or whatever, that dream universe is gone. The whole thing's gone. Just like that. And nothing has happened. Thing is totally gone. Nothing has happened because nothing has happened. That's mithya. What is mithya? Does not affect satyam. Right? It does not affect satyam. It's a different order of reality. It comes into being and goes out of being. Satyam remains as it is all the time. So now, in all of your experience, every moment of your experience, inviolate, you can't get away from it, all of your experience is taking place in satyam, the satyam of your being, the me, conscious being. It's inviolate. Nothing ever happens to it. All of your thoughts, all of your moods, all of your feelings, all of your diseases, your illnesses, and your growing old, all of these things that are existing within time and space are mithya. Because upon any analysis, you certainly can't find anything there. It all goes into infinite regress in terms of trying to find a thing in the first place. Though what's interesting is as you're searching to find the thing, it's always taking place in than the satchit of your being. As you analyze, 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 you are quietly there. That's why in contemplation, you know, we're looking at all of these things, always bringing it back to the recognition of yourself is always just quietly there. Your own swarupa, your own nature remains absolutely changeless. And that, you can't do anything about it. That's moksha. Your nature is so whole and so complete and inviolate. Even if you're really being a jerk. Yeah. No matter what, your being blesses that jerkiness. Just always exactly the same. Always the same. There's not a thing you can do about it. Which is such a relief, because we always we're always afraid of wrecking something, or we need to make it better. We want to make it better, or we want to protect it. But Atma, you can't make better, and you can't protect it. It doesn't need to be protected. Right? So, and that is who you are. That's your being. And so this viveka has to take place, right? This viveka, discrimination, like we did in the meditation, is the discrimination of my recognizing myself amidst this maya. But all of the ones that are trying to do the recognition are within the maya. Mm-hmm. So we're just used to looking out at things, analyzing things, so that we can find the truth here with our means of knowledge, analyzing within duality. Whereas I'm the very one that is the self of the duality. Right? A different order of reality. So that needs to be recognized. Let's stop here. This 8 and 8 and 9, we'll work on more on 8 and move into 9. Next time. I haven't quite finished it yet. Swasti prajapyat paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishaha go brahmane vyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyaha prithivi sasya shalini desho yamksho barahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vishishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
So at one point you said something about Bhagavan gives us this something.
Oh, it's just my appreciating that we have the dream.
Yes.
The dream and also not just the dream, but also imagination, so that you can appreciate Maya.
And you've used phrases like that, with that stem at least, recently a couple of other times. And what comes up for me is, how could it be, I mean, first of all, why is there this personification, which I know I've asked.
What do you mean, personification?
Well, it seems that when you say Bhagavan, he, and does it like lends a personality to something that to me is kind of impersonal, and that also is not a doer.
Right.
And so...
That's just a form of
speech. It starts to sound like Western...
Yeah.
You know, you know, theism.
Well, let me say it in a different way. It's, to me, I mean, that we have the dream.
Yes.
That can be used as an example. Which to me makes complete sense, because the whole creation is Maya. What you have as an individual is not separate from the whole. Right? So the material that gives you this upadi, right, is the very Maya that is the same material of the whole universe. And so on a limited level, that you have that capacity, you're like a little Ishwara to your dream, or a little Ishwara to your imagination, shows the relationship between consciousness and Maya. And so that exists in the creation is a beautiful thing.
Yes, it's a beautiful thing, and I'm grateful that it's the Achilles heel.
But now what you don't like, when I say, you know, isn't it amazing that, you know, that Bhagavan gave us the dream.
Yes.
I don't mean that Bhagavan's a little man in heaven who came and gave us the dream. As a gift. Let me give you this dream as a gift. Now the dream exists as part of the creation, you know. On the other hand, if you're talking in that way, if I'm talking it that way, I'm also acknowledging that not that there's a creator, a little man in heaven, who actually, if there's a little man in heaven, who created the heaven that allows the little man to be there. Yeah, so that doesn't make any sense. But it's just acknowledging that this whole creation is a conscious being. In fact, this whole creation is a manifestation, you know, as Swamiji calls incidental attribute, because mitya, of my being. And so, just like from the standpoint of the individual, I can say, I am a conscious being, I have a mind, my experience is known to me. So like if I say, now your eyes are open and you have a vritti, a thought modification of this room, because you have a thought modification that is born through your sense perception, this whole room is enjoying your consciousness, it is enjoying knownness, that the room is known. Right? So if you think, same me, exactly the same me, but not attached, not attaching it, not experiencing it through this limited upadi, but looking at this whole infinite expression of knowledge, this infinite manifestation of knowledge, as enjoined from its own standpoint, me. Or like you, so there you are over here, over there, here I am, here. So now, having a limited mind, you having a limited mind, you have a limited experience, different from mine at this moment, right? But same one consciousness, but the whatever is your experience, that is known, right? So for you, for me, for all beings, but for the whole creation, all of these limited jivas are part and parcel of that whole creation, more like a dream. When you have a dream, there's all these jivas in the dream, right? But the whole, for you, you may be identified with one of them in the dream, but you are also Ishwara of the dream. So there's two things happening. Say if you're dreaming, there's two realities for you. You're either identified with a character in the dream or not. But in either case, you're the one for whom the dream is known, the whole dream. And then you can also experience the dream from within the dream, walking around in it. And so here in this waking state, in this world as a jiva, we don't get to experience the Ishwara Swarupa in terms of the whole as me, This is my, this infinite creation is my upadhi. The whole thing is known. I do get a glimpse of that in the dream where I recognize the whole dream world that I'm experiencing. I'm the Ishwara of that dream. It is me. See what I mean? I don't get to have that experience. But I understand that experience through the Shastra. I get a little bit of that. I get my own little section, you know, of experience of Ishwara as in terms of the Prarabdha Karma. But I recognize through infinite extension and understanding the Shastra that in fact this whole infinite creation, that's why we call it Ishwara, is known. And the conscious being because of which it is known is me. Right? And so I look at this creation as Bhagavan. So I'm not talking about a little man in heaven. I'm talking about this creation as a manifestation of infinite knowledge, of being myself, as having a self, and that self which it has is my own being. And so it isn't just Mother Nature. It's Bhagavan. So now if I say, you think maybe I'm anthropomorphizing, but I'm not really, but I understand the problem. However, what I'm saying, isn't it fantastic that Bhagavan, this infinite conscious being, you know, includes, for each one of the jivas, it includes that you have a dream, that you have imagination, because that's the Achilles heel to really understanding. Because I can hold up, and which of the whole chapter 2 and 3 in the Mandukya Upanishad, especially chapter 2, is doing exactly this, holding up the dream to the waking state, the dream state to the waking state. In both cases, both are mithya equally. There's dream state is no more or less mithya than the waking state. They're both mithya. They both enjoy the same self that is not touched by either one of them. You know? You can say when you're comparing the waking state to the dream that one is greater than the, this is a bigger joke, Swamiji will say. The waking state lasts longer than the dream. But in terms of the Atma, you know, it's the same. And so I'm saying, oh, Bhagavan, isn't it great that Bhagavan... But it's...
Well, I, when you use the word includes, I'm way more comfortable as opposed to gives us. So that takes care of the doership problem.
Okay, good.
Then there's a still a question. When... If we look at, instead of the dream, an imagination, say the meadow. And
yeah, like imagination
that,
in the meadow, okay.
Right, the traditional thing. And there's a way in which our mind is creating that imagination.
Right.
Are you saying that this whole thing is being created by a bigger mind or something? That's kind of the other part.
Well,
of
no, not like there's...
Is there some, you know, something... Ishwara is bigger in the sense that it's all existence, but consciousness is the same, ultimately, for me and for Ishwara, even though there's this jiva here.
No, consciousness doesn't have any size. It's non-dual.
Yeah,
right?
so... is there like a bigger mind or awareness or buddhi or something?
There's not a bigger awareness.
Ishwara has.
Okay, there's not going to be a bigger awareness. The awareness that you are is the awareness that Ishwara is. So that has nothing to do with size. And now when you say, is there a bigger mind? What if you think, I don't know quite what you mean by that, because do you mean there's this great giant body that has this great giant mind?
What I mean is, so the way, in the same way that we can create an imaginary meadow with people, flowers, rocks, grass, trees, whatever, insects, birds, we can populate that and it does all kinds of things and we can identify with parts of it, just like with the dream,
Okay. Except
that there's a more intentional creation there. Is there something like that going on for Ishwara with this whole thing? Because I get it, it sounds
not,
like that when you talk about
Okay, it's not going on in the sense of a volition. Like there's a mind that says, oh, let me create the creation now. Not like that. Because the creation, say you have non-dual awareness, okay, which is not going to be doing anything. From the standpoint of awareness, there's no beginning, there's no end, there's no volition, there's no creation from awareness. Awareness is just awareness, such it. It's not doing anything. Maya
also is not something that is created. Who's going to create it? It's not going to create itself. So what is mitya has is also not created. It's not timeless, it's beginningless. And so maya hasn't decided, oh, let me do this or let me do that. So that what that means also is Ishvara hasn't. How is Ishvara created? That's kind of an interesting question. Like, who was God's father? Did God have a grandfather or what? Who created God? Right. So we say, for Ishvara, for Brahman, being free of time, there is no time. There's no change. So Brahman is as Brahman is. If you go down from the standpoint of the universe, within time, if you go back billions of years, Brahman is timeless. Exactly the me that is here at this moment is the me that's there in all moments because Brahman is free from time. Okay? And nor does Brahman have hands or legs or volition to be creating or making anything. And so then what do we do with this maya? We say, well, then who created the maya? Well, we say, nobody created the maya. Maya is beginningless. That means that Ishvara is beginningless because Ishvara is Brahman, timeless, with this maya incidental attribute that has to be given to Brahman, but it can't be given as a real attribute that in any way touches or changes Brahman. That's why we say it's mitya. Like there's nothing the pot can do to hurt the clay. Nothing.
Then there's, why talk about Bhagavan? Because that seems very misleading.
Because conscious being. It's a conscious being. Why talk about God?
You have the same question.
Okay, well here, okay. What I was meaning by that is, like if you say, did God have a beginning? Even in Christianity or any of the religions, I don't think, philosophize a beginning of God having a beginning because God is the one from whom, who is omniscient and omnipotent, and the one from whom the creation has come. We use all kinds of language like that. So we don't think of God as having a beginning. And so, but now, say from going back to Vedanta, timeless Atma, timeless self, beginningless creation, okay? Beginningless maya. Maya is something that's viewed by the Upanishads or revealed by the Upanishads as cyclical, that comes into being, sustained, goes out of being from beginningless time. You can't know that. That's what the Upanishads have to say. When you understand what the Upanishads say, so much logic and experience can substantiate that, but you can't get to it yourself. You can't go beyond time to get to that, to say that the creation is beginningless and cyclical. But once you can understand it, it can make sense to you, but that's it. Right? But so that's what the Upanishads have to say. Say that it says that. Now you say, if you're going to ask something like, so the maya, Brahman is as Brahman is, timeless, creation is beginningless, then God, whoever is what we say, Ishvara, you can't now say something like, well, why is Ishvara like this? You know, why is Ishvara like this?
I have an easier time with the word Ishvara because I understand it as Brahman plus the maya.
Okay.
Fine. We call it Ishvara. But then Bhagavan, when that term is used, it implies almost a personality and those kind of things. So that's what...
Well, maybe that's your conditioning on the word Bhagavan.
Yes, because in Sanskrit, the word Bhagavan means divine effulgence. It doesn't have that connotation
of
like
God.
A person or God. It's a semantic issue here.
Maybe it's not just a semantic issue
for him.
I don't know if it is or not. I think it's semantic, but there's something... It's semantic, but there's something else. And that is, if you think of yourself as a person, a conscious being, okay? You are a conscious being, right? I mean, I'm just using simple language here. I hope you say you're a conscious being.
Well, yeah, but that could mean different things depending on what you mean by a conscious being. I mean, it could mean I am...
Well, in terms of the Vedanta that we've been unfolding, if I say you're a conscious being, and you have a body, mind, sense organs, and you enjoy consciousness. We've done all this viveka, subject-object relationship, to realize what we mean by consciousness.
Okay.
And the mind enjoys consciousness, the sense organs enjoy consciousness, the sukshma shriya, all of these things we've been going teaching.
Yes. Okay.
So now I say you are a conscious being, and I expect that you know what I mean by that.
I think so.
Okay. Now the consciousness...
Should ask one more thing.
He's hard to pin down.
Okay. Okay. What I'm saying is that the consciousness, which you are, that conscious being, is the consciousness which this whole universe enjoys.
Okay.
So it's the whole universe enjoys consciousness like your mind enjoys consciousness. So now that's why if I ask you to have, for I would do different examples, I ask you to imagine a meadow, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And you notice that whole imagination, you've evoked meadow knowledge. There's a manifestation of meadow knowledge. That meadow knowledge enjoys consciousness. You are the conscious being that illumines that meadow and gives being to that meadow, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what I've asked you to do when I asked you to think of a meadow is another way of saying that is the unmanifest meadow knowledge is coming into manifestation.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes into manifestation, it's known.
Mm-hmm.
That's your experience. It is and it is known, right? Okay. The universe, when the universe comes from unmanifest condition, like the meadow, but now it's infinite knowledge in the form of everything that exists within duality, comes into manifestation. In the same way that the sattva mind that you enjoy knownness, that meadow enjoys knownness, in the same way the infinite creation enjoys knownness. The knownness is your own swarupa, the nature of the Atma, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we say that there's what we call abhimana. Abhimana means just like when you have the knowledge of the meadow, the experience of the meadow, your being, the being is this me, the me experience. Not as an object, but as just a word to focus your attention on the personal nature of awareness. It is you. Okay? That same you now is reflected in the infinite manifest knowledge. So that's the abhimana. The abhimana is that sense of me from the standpoint of the infinite creation that makes it Ishwara. Otherwise we should just say there's non-dual consciousness. There's non-dual consciousness and this infinite creation, Mother Nature, right? This Mother Nature has for its swarupa, has for its nature, non-dual consciousness, but it's only nature. Like, it's all kind of like a table. You know? It's like this whole infinite creation is like a table. In the sense that it itself doesn't have any sense of, it doesn't have that abhimana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? But we say, no, it's Ishwara.
So what's abhimana?
Abhimana is that sense of me, not like an ahankara, but just the me-ness.
Consciousness.
Yeah, consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so like any thought that you have, whether you're jnani or not, whether you have self-knowledge or not, any thought you have or your body that has the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, that abhimana is always there. Because the sukshma sharira goes through the whole body. You know, and so that sense of meanness in the body is going to be there as long as the body is here. Even though it's not that there's no viveka, but from the mirror-like nature of the body, because of the sukshma sharira, will give that sense of meanness to the body, to the mind, to the thoughts, to the sense organs.
And everyone has that experience.
Everybody does, yeah. So the whole universe, because this upadhi is limited, it has a limited abhimana, sense of me, you know. Your sukshma sharira, your upadhi would have to extend to be the whole creation for this simple me,
mm-hmm.
right? To be the abhimana of the creation. To be the abhimana of the creation, you have to be the creation. That has to be your upadhi.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just a little jiva within the upadhi.
Mm-hmm.
But yourself is the self of all beings and the self
the self of the creation, the self of all beings. I mean, Tibby and the worm and Hero and all of our little ones have exactly the same abhimana, the same sense of me, because that's who they are. The whole creation has that, because the creation is nothing but the self. Right? Just like the pot is nothing but clay. But from its own standpoint, we call it Ishwara because sattva, rajas and tamas pervade the entire creation. And so the sattva aspect of the maya allows for that knownness of the creation. Otherwise, there's just the non-dual knownness of Brahman, right, of me, and the manifest creation is unknown even though it's there. It's there, but it's unknown. You say, no, from the Shastra, it is known because of the sattva. So it is like an infinite mind. That's why we call it Hiranyagarbha. Virat is the five, the Mahabhutas, the five sense elements that have gone through Panchikarana, becoming fivefold, become tamas. So we call this Virat, Hiranyagarbha, Ishwara. Brahman, just with Maya, is what we call Ishwara. The Maya manifests, its first level of manifestation, Sukshma, we call Hiranyagarbha, the infinite mind. Going through the Panchikarana, it becomes this physical world, Virat.
And the finite mind doesn't have that infinite capacity. Well, it doesn't have the capacity of the infinite mind.
Of course not.
So the infinite mind, so I was talking about there's a bigger mind, and I thought you said there wasn't.
Well,
and
I don't
saying
pick
an infinite mind, that sounds a lot bigger than this mind.
Well, I don't like you saying the saying little mind, infinite mind, as though there's an infinite mind who's creating this.
Mm-hmm.
The whole manifest creation, right, because of the sattva, is known. In fact, I'm not going to do this now, but I'm going to do it for 5 minutes, because I'm starting to burn out a little bit.
Okay.
When your mind is manifest, right, and with your sense organs, there is no knower here, there's just knownness. The ahankara makes up this knower. You do not have the experience of a knower. You have the experience all the way through of only knownness. Knownness plus the upadi, that's it. There's no knower. The ahankara comes along and divides up your experience and creates a knower. It creates a knower. You know, saying this, when like in your mind, there's the names and forms that are known, and there's the consciousness, the knownness that those names and forms have. Well, you're not going to, in your thought, no, I'm not thinking I'm this, and I'm this, and I'm this, and I'm this. No, I'm the conscious being because of which this is known, which I call the knower. I give knowership to it to differentiate myself from what is known. I'm different from what is known. That differentiation does not take place in reference to the upadis, however. It will once when the viveka takes place, that same differentiation that takes place for anything external to my body takes place with the body and the mind and the sense organs also. And then I start realizing everything just enjoys the self-evident nature of Brahman, right? That which is what is actually here. Brahman is self-evident knownness. Whole creation goes away like in the dream. What is left? Self-evident me. And so the whole creation, when the maya is manifest as manifestation of infinite knowledge, what is the self of that manifestation of infinite knowledge? Knownness. The whole thing is known. Right? The knownness experience is there, but now the question is, does this infinite manifestation reflect, in a sense, like my mind does? And the Shastra said, yes. So you either have Shraddha in the Shastra or you don't, because you cannot get there. You can't get there. It's not possible, you know, for you, with the means of knowledge that you have available to you, to make that jump. But with all of the things that you can have, what we call aparoksha, immediate knowledge of, as it's unfolded to you, have immediate direct knowledge of, with that knowledge, you can afford to make these infinite extensions that are backed by the Shastra. But you can't, you don't have a means of knowledge to get there yourself. Once you get there, then all of your experience and all of your logic can support it, as well as can negate any other position you might take. That's why, you know, in the 10th man story is so important, they knock off the first nine. The old man comes, knocks off the first nine. Each one of those is another position. So try to find another position. Really, the Shastra, the Upanishads, will say any other position is like a piece of straw against the wind. It can't withstand inquiry. You know? If it can withstand inquiry, then it's, to whatever degree it can withstand inquiry, to that degree it should be taken seriously, but at some point it falls. Because it can't withstand the pramana. Now, it doesn't have to be Vedic pramana. Any pramana won't withstand the pramana. It won't withstand logic. It won't withstand experience. Your experience. It has to be able to withstand it. Inquiry has to be supported by pramana. It has to be logical, and it has to jive with your experience. You know. And so, the Shastra itself has so much to give you to make you see, but it's making you see things that you can't see yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't have the means of knowledge for it. You don't have the means of knowledge to recognize your own, the infinite nature of your own being. Because the sense organs and the pramanas that you have available to you are only good looking within duality. But the reason you can have aparoksha, direct, immediate recognition of your own being, is because you're there. So the Upanishad can point to it, and it is you, and so you can differentiate it and recognize it.
Okay.
So, but it's another thing to recognize the Ishvara Upadhi.
Can I ask, so that's, because that's a question that keeps recurring to me. You know, this teaching shows you very clearly the self-evident nature of your own being,
yeah,
and of your own consciousness. Mm-hmm. Right? But then there does seem to be a bit of a leap to go, and I can see also epistemologically that, in terms of epistemology, that everything that I know,
yeah,
depends upon me being here as a conscious being, right? But that there still seems to be a leap to the position of that ontologically I am foundational or immortal.
Why? Why would that be a leap? I don't know why that. I think that's where you're still within a paroksha jnanam there. The leap for me,
mm-hmm,
is Ishvara as a conscious being, and that requires the Shastra, because that can't be a paroksha. The aparokshatvam, mm-hmm, of consciousness itself.
Yeah.
Is there, that's not a leap.
No, not of consciousness, but that it's immortal and...
well, what does immortal mean to you? Immortal would mean that it's free of the body, mind, sense organs.
Right.
Or
epistemologically, see, I don't think in India they make a distinction between epistemology and ontology the way we do. I mean, epistemologically, yes, I can see it, but somehow ontologically, in other words...
What do you mean by ontology, then?
I mean in terms of... Well, I mean in terms of my existence, actually.
But you have to... Even to question...
Surviving death, so to speak. Right?
Yeah, but then we have to do a whole different analysis there to really understand that, is to analyze matter itself.
Mm-hmm.
For you to even think that there is such a thing as matter.
As death.
Matter, M-A-T-T-E-R,
right.
Matter. That,
mm-hmm,
that there is, that this matter, this body is material. The brain is material, it's matter.
Mm-hmm.
And because of this matter, I exist. But I would say there isn't any matter.
So you say that, so you say this is aparoksha, you don't need the pramana of the Shastra to...
No, I don't say that. You do need the pramana of the shastra, but the shastra gives you direct, immediate knowledge, not indirect knowledge.
Okay.
Where you get indirect knowledge, you can't have the experience unless, I don't know, like Krishna gave it to Arjuna. You're not going to have the experience of the Ishwara Upadhi. Or the cyclical nature of the creation. So that you require Shraddha.
See, because your own self-existent nature, you don't even need really the Shastra necessarily for it. It can be pointed out, I think, logically and experientially, that you exist, you know, I am a conscious being.
I guess.
But I think it's, but you do need the pramana, I think.
No, you can say, I exist, I'm a conscious being, but can you say that conscious being is free of time and not objectifiable and is free of time and therefore the same in all beings? We can all, but one of the important point here.
You can see that time is in a certain way a creation of your knowledge, right? In other words, it doesn't have any independent existence.
Well, what if you were to say that none of this has any independent existence?
Yeah, okay. Again, I guess I'm going around in circles because, again, I'd say ontology. I still make this. I don't know what that is. There's a little doubt there based on this distinction.
I've got like two minutes of brain left. But tell me again what you mean between existence and ontology. What are you saying that the West does differently than the East in terms of these two things?
It's one thing to like talk about how you know what your experience of reality is based on what you know and can know.
That's epistemology. Right. Yeah.
And it's another thing to say, but what is actually there? So the fact that
But you can't get to what is actually there from your own pramanas.
Right.
Because your own pramanas are...
Right, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. You do need the pramana for that.
Yes, you do. But that part, but the difference is that that pramana is pointing to something which is self-evident. And so it's not indirect.
Okay, no, all right. I understand the difference. Anyway, I'm not saying it's indirect,
But it's aparoksha.
I'm saying it's aparoksha.
Yeah.
But only with the use of the pramana.
But remember, there's another subtle thing here. The pramana removes ignorance. The knowledge you're getting is not the gain of something. It's the removal. It's ajnana nivritti. It's the removal of self-ignorance. So the self that has always been there, you're not coming into contact with a new experience or a new self. You're removing from yourself the ajnanam that it's caused, the superimposition. Right? So yourself is just left as you are without the ignorance that has caused you to take yourself to be things that are actually objectified. Yeah. But we'll go on more.